True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
Today we have something different than our usual episodes, because Dick was recently fortunate enough to speak with Joel Schwartz. That's the defense attorney for Russ Faria in the murder of his wife, Betsy. So this is a case that we did cover with an episode on November 15th, 2021, after watching five Datelines about it. We titled our episode Pam's Path to Prison. So if you haven't listened to that yet, we suggest you go back and listen to that episode before listening to this interview with Joel Schwartz.
So despite having an airtight alibi, Russ Faria was convicted of killing his wife Betsy. Now this conviction did get overturned on appeal, and then in a second trial, Russ was acquitted. But there's more to this bizarre story. And you're going to see, as we interview Joel, the more we learn about the case, the weirder it gets. Now, Joel's a prominent St. Louis criminal defense attorney, and he has written a book about this case titled Bone Deep. Jill and I were given the opportunity to read Bone Deep before its release. Now, not only is it detailed, it's a very entertaining read. So before we get into the nuts and bolts of the case, Joel, could you give us a brief overview of the case and your involvement?
Suffice it to say, I've been doing this 33 years, and that's all I've done is quote-unquote true crime as a criminal defense attorney, and I've never seen anything even remotely close to something along these lines. To call it weird, while being true, is probably an understatement. This started with a faulty investigation in most ways, with one exception, which is what makes it so strange. And I will get to that down the road here. But ultimately what happened is Russ Faria came home one evening, found his wife brutally stabbed, as it turns out, over 50-something times. He went to trial. He was convicted of murder in the first degree. It was what I would call a trial fraught with faults. Ultimately, the case was sent back to the trial court. He was acquitted, and the individual who I believed was responsible for this went and attempted to reframe Mr. Faria by killing another individual, ultimately, which she was convicted for and sentenced to life without parole. And as we sit here today, I don't want to ruin the surprise ending. However, she has been now charged with this murder from 2011 of Betsy Faria. To get into the facts, we'll take, I think, the entirety of the time we have allotted for today. So let's have at it.
Well, we'll try to hit upon the salient points.
All righty.
And besides Russ's acquittal, there's the murder of Louis Gumpenberger, and he's this completely innocent man, and his murder was an apparent attempt by Pam to swing suspicions of Betsy's murder back to Russ.
Lest we forget about her mother.
So that's another part of it, too.
Yes.
Now, it seems to me that as soon as the police arrived at the murder scene and they saw Betsy's body, they were focused right away on Russ as her killer.
I would agree with that, however inexplicable that may be. What occurred is Russ Faria showed up at home. It happened to be Tuesday night. Every Tuesday, Russ goes to what he refers to as game night with four other individuals. Russ showed up at home. His wife, Betsy, who had been recently diagnosed with terminal cancer, was lying dead on the floor. There was a massive cut on her wrist, almost where her hand was sawed off, with a large kitchen knife sticking out of her neck. Russ, obviously, as anyone would do, he panicked. He didn't know what to do. He called 911. This was what I believed tripped this investigation towards Russ. He called in and he said, "My wife, I just came home from a friend's house and my wife is dead. I think she committed suicide." And I think he said that approximately three times, maybe even four times during the course of that 911 call. The police showed up and believing, okay, he's trying to trick us. And as is generally the case, the husband must have killed the wife. He flew into some sort of blind rage and killed her. So he was without question the suspect immediately thereupon once the police arrived. I have always stated that they did an incredibly poor investigation. However, I've actually changed my tune on that to a degree. What the police did in Russ being the suspect is their initial investigation with the major case squad, which is sort of a conglomeration of what's termed to be the top police officers throughout the metro area, had been brought together in an attempt to solve this crime. Because as we and all your listeners know, the first 12 hours, 24 hours is immensely important. So what Russ did is he went into police custody, although he was not told that he was a suspect at the time. He was told they needed his help in order to solve his wife's murder. But what they did is they talked to Russ over the span of the next 36 hours. Had Russ called me when he was taken in, I would have said, as any good criminal lawyer would have said, keep your mouth shut. I'll be there in the morning or I'm on my way. I don't want you to say anything. However, he called nobody. He volunteered information as to his whereabouts throughout the entire day, throughout the entire night, fortunately. And I say that because they were able to go to each one of his stops on his way to his friend's house. They were able to get videotapes from three of them and a receipt from the fourth. And he was actually remembered at the fourth where they merely had a receipt. They were able to get him in these videos in the clothing he was wearing, which was exactly the same as what he was arrested in that evening without one speck of blood. They were able to get a timestamp receipt from the place where he stopped, which was Arby's, on the way home from his friend's house. They were able to go to his friend's house, find these four alibi witnesses, separate them, talk to them individually, all whom supported his claim that he was there from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. The receipt from the Arby's was at 9:09 p.m., and then he drove home and arrived home approximately 30 minutes later, which was all confirmed by cell site, and called 911 about 40 seconds later upon going into the house. Thankfully, Russ did tell the police all this. They were able to confirm everything he said. And as I have said from the day I was in this case, they were able to prove his innocence, virtually making it impossible to have done this. So the million-dollar question being, how did we end up here?
Well, that would certainly be my question, because he's got four witnesses that corroborate everything that he's told the cops.
That's correct.
I'm thinking this should go to trial for him.
Once I got involved, it wasn't, in looking at the evidence, it was clear that he didn't do this. There are other factors involved. For example, there were two first responders that went in. They testified and they stated in their reports that the blood was coagulated, that her body was stiff and cool to the touch, obviously given that she had been dead for a few hours. And we know where he was by not only the four alibi witnesses, but confirmed by his cell site as well. It's inexplicable to me 10 years after the fact as to why they didn't look to alternate suspects. Because in this particular case, they had one served up to them on a silver platter, and that would be Pam Hupp. They went to visit Miss Hupp the next morning because by all accounts, she was the last one with Betsy Faria. The first question they asked her was what time she dropped her off. And then did you go in the house with her? The answer was no, I didn't. Remember, this was about 10, 11 hours prior to them going to visit Pam, and her friend was killed. Well, her story changed immediately. Over the course of a 3.5-hour interview, I would say Pam Hupp told lie after lie after lie. Not only became provable in the months surrounding this, but her story changed throughout the course of the interview. For example, they arrived home at 7:04 p.m., and we know that based upon not only Pam's cell site, but there was a call from Ms. Hupp to her husband, who was at home at the time. It all went to voicemail, and Betsy's voice, alive, was at least apparently on that call, wishing Mr. Hupp Happy New Year, Merry Christmas. This was December the 27th. So we know Betsy was alive at 7:04. There is a call from Pam Hupp's cell phone to Betsy's phone at 7:27, some 23 minutes later. Betsy missed three calls from her daughter between 7:21 and 7:29 that she had promised to answer, indicating to any sane individual that she was either probably involved in a struggle or deceased at that time, certainly based upon what the first responders had reported. So why is the 7:27 call important? Well, it's important because the first officers who went and responded to Pam Hupp's home the next morning asked her why she called Betsy. And her response was to let her know that I was home safe. And they looked at the call and they questioned her, and this is all recorded. They said, well, you live over 30 minutes away. You couldn't have been home if you arrived there at 7:04. And then she said, well, what I meant was I was home. I was almost home. Well, where were you? Well, what I meant was I was home free, meaning there was a major highway intersection that she alluded to that she had made it. I didn't accept those answers, and I subpoenaed her cell site information. What the cell site showed was that during that 727 call, she was still within the same sector based upon cell site, meaning she was at or in the house at the time that she was making that phone call, which I've always called her alibi call. The fact that the police didn't, at the very least, take these things and say, let's take a look at this individual and figure out why she is lying to us. I have left the coup de grace out. That happens to be that for some inexplicable reason, the Friday before, this was a Tuesday that Betsy was brutalized. The Friday before, apparently, for no certain reason, changed the beneficiary of her life insurance policy from Russ Faria, her husband, whose name it had been in for the last decade, to Pam Hupp. We all know it's detective work, police work 101. You follow the money, you follow the motive. They chose not to do this in this case. And other than confirmation bias, simply meaning they wanted to confirm their initial conclusion, I can't give you any valid reason as to why they didn't look into Pam Hupp.
Yeah. And you said in the book that once you read her interview, you knew she was the murderer.
Well, I don't want to make assumptions and jump to conclusions like the police did. But at the very, very least, somebody needed to take a good, long, hard look at her, which they never did. I read the report, and there's no reason to lie about going in the home. There's no reason to lie about making the phone call. And that is mixed in with so many other falsities that Pam Hupp told, including attempting to portray Russ and push the detectives towards Russ as the suspect, an individual who, at that time, she said, I barely know him. I've met him maybe two or three times, and he seems like a nice enough guy. Well, as you now know, and hopefully your listeners will find out after they buy the book, boy, did her story change from I barely know the guy, and he was a nice guy, to he threatened to cut me up with his breath and his spittle flying into my face, bury me in the backyard. To this day, I don't know why the stop gaps that are in the system didn't work, from the police to the prosecutor to the court and then to the jury. Although I can give the jury a pass because of the court's rulings, the jury was simply not allowed to hear the evidence of Pam Hupp's lies. I was not allowed to cross-examine her in the presence of the jury regarding those. And they were not allowed to hear, believe it or not, about the insurance beneficiary changed.
Yeah, none of that. And this was the judge. It seems like there was maybe a little bit of animosity between you and the judge and the prosecuting attorney.
It didn't start out that way. However, as each ridiculous court ruling was made, the animosity would increase. The boiling over point with the prosecutor came during her closing argument, which I describe in detail in the book, all in my book, Bone Deep. All of the conversations, all of the transcripts, all of the language in there is taken verbatim from the arguments. People who have read the book have said to me, it's incredulous. So if this was fiction, I would have put it down because it's too unbelievable. Her closing argument to the jury was unethical, irresponsible. And I have to say, given the result, apparently persuasive. It was based not on any of the evidence. It was based on nothing other than conjecture and frankly, lies. And the court allowed her to go ahead and do that. Up until that point, the relationship with the prosecutor started is interesting. She called me the biggest jerk, using some more colorful language than I can state on your program, that she had ever dealt with, which simply isn't true. And it got worse and worse. And as it moved on, nobody would look at Pam Hupp as a suspect. My frustrations grew. And my frustrations grew not only with the prosecutor, but with the court. I felt when I got this case and I read the discovery, it was clear absolutely clear. Not only could I show that there was a reasonable doubt, I could go so far beyond that and prove that Russ Faria didn't do it. And frankly, I could have proven then, and I still believe I can prove today, even though there was a lack of investigation, that Pam Hupp was the one behind this. So much so, an honest to God true story, my son, who was a seventh grader at the time, sat down with me one night. For whatever reason, he asked if he could help me. I said, of course. He sat down and he read the police reports for about a half hour. And he looked at me and he said, Dad, I know who did it. Like it was an Encyclopedia Brown story.
Yeah.
And I asked him who, and he said, it was that lady. It was Pam Hupp. I said, you know, it seems that you're smarter than the entire police department, because nobody in Lincoln County ever once took a step back and said, as somebody should have, hold on, he's got an alibi. His cell site backs it up. He's got the receipts. He has no blood on him. Why don't we step back and take a look at this? I kept trying to get that to happen. I really, truly believe this case would never proceed to trial. I couldn't have been more wrong, because nobody ever did what I'm describing.
No, they didn't. What was the basis, or do you know the basis of the judge's rulings about why you couldn't admit evidence pointing to Pam Hupp?
Yes. The basis was, according to this judge, now this judge had never handled a murder case before, and we were in one of the jurisdictions in Missouri that's an elected county. So the problem that I have with elected judges as opposed to appointed judges is it becomes a popularity contest. And if you want to retain your seat on the bench, you have to be tough on crime and you have to sort of please the whims of the public. So I don't believe this judge had enough experience to understand what the case law was. So in Missouri, there is a rule called a direct connection. For example, let's say there's a rape at point A, and there is a sex offender that lives at point B that's about a mile away. I can't simply insert that point B person into the case unless I have some sort of direct connection. That direct connection could be a witness seeing that person in front of the house. That direct connection can be the person made a threat. They had been together. Anything at all to show that there is some connection. Well, in this particular case, Pam Hupp not only was the last person with her, not only forced herself on her during the day, lied about everything, but also had the insurance proceeds. And I kept arguing to the court, there's so much more of a connection here than there is to my client, Russ Faria. All you're doing is interpreting this as because Russ Faria is the one who's charged, therefore there's a direct connection. She couldn't seem to grasp that simple notion. It got so frustrating to a point where when we were getting ready to cross-examine Pam Hupp and the court was limiting my cross, the state had wanted us to provide some case law. The prosecutor provided a case which does accurately say that the scope of cross-examination can be limited, meaning that I can't go into Pam Hupp's or witness's life when they were 6 years old and went to visit Disneyland with their family. That's simply not relevant. But what I can get into are the relevant facts of the case. And I stacked about five at a time, up to 100 cases, where it got to the point where the judge could no longer actually even see me from her bench. I tried to make a point. I was also being a bit of a jerk, and it still didn't work. The judge ruled against me, and as we know how the Court of Appeals felt about that, it came back pretty quickly.
Yes, it did.
Yes.
You had made repeated motions for mistrial during the trial.
Yeah, that was frustrating. Well, again, the judge ruled that I could not get into the insurance proceeds and the change of the insurance beneficiaries. And I think it was the second or third sentence in the trial, the prosecutor got up and said, this case is about one thing, greed. He killed his wife, Betsy Faria, in order to get her insurance proceeds. And I went ballistic. I made a motion for a mistrial. Court then reviewed its rulings. And this gives you some insight into the experience. The court said, my ruling was that you couldn't get into the insurance. It says nothing about the state. And I was flabbergasted. I said, Judge, that's fine, but the door has now been opened and I have every right to get into that. Well, I'm not going to allow that, Mr. Schwartz. All right, well, then you need to grant me a mistrial because that defied the court's ruling and it planted the seed and it can't be taken. Well, that was the first motion and the court overruled me. There were many other motions. The one to me that was the most outrageous was, and again, these, you don't have to be a lawyer, you don't have to be experienced to know that when it's not supposed to come in from one side, it can't come in with the other. But what everybody knows is polygraphs don't come into evidence. prosecutor asked the alibi witnesses with no basis because it was untrue to each alibi witness. You refused to take a polygraph. I went crazy. Number one, it wasn't true. Number two, even if it were true, it's inadmissible. But the court again denied my motion for a mistrial based upon those questions of the prosecutor. And that's where I talk about the inappropriateness and the lack of ethics in this prosecution.
Yes. And at the end of the trial, you asked for a directed verdict of acquittal that was denied.
We're talking about the first trial.
First trial, yes.
Absolutely denied. And I still felt, I didn't feel that I knew in my gut, there was no way that this jury was going to convict him. There simply was no evidence.
Yeah.
The argument that was made was based on nothing but pure fantasy created in the prosecutor's mind. I still don't understand what the jury had to talk about in rendering a guilty verdict. I have heard through the grapevine that some of the jurors were very, very happy that he got a second trial, and they were very upset that they didn't hear about the evidence regarding Pam Hupp.
Well, yes. I think you wrote those initially six in favor of acquittal and six opposed.
That's what I was told. I don't know how those six that were opposed or six that were in favor of acquittal were convinced. I don't know what facts could have possibly been presented to them.
Yeah, but you're feeling like you've fallen through the looking glass anyway. So
I feel like what?
That you went through the looking glass into Wonderland or something.
Yeah, it was never Neverland or Wonderland. It was crazy. The whole case has been somewhat surreal, and I'm still going through it now, given that there's going to be a six-part TV series made with a character named Joel Schwartz, who is more or less the hero of the story. It's a lot of fun. It's still a bit surreal for me.
you told Russ, or I think I read this, that you told Russ after the verdict that you were going to make sure he got a new trial.
I was confident. I knew all of the mistakes that had been made. I've won appeals before. I've never had any case with as much error. I don't think I've ever had a case that had 10% or more than 10% the error that this case had. It was error after error after error. Yeah. So much so that after we filed our appeal, we then filed a motion on newly discovered evidence. So in effect, the court, while it was overturned on appeal, the actual content of the appeal itself was never heard because the court sent it back on this evidence that hadn't been disclosed. And under the court's ruling, what's termed a Mooney motion, the court sent it back. And the language is under a Mooney motion that it's evidence so egregious that had a jury heard it, it most likely would have resulted in a different outcome. So the court sent it back to the trial court, essentially for a new hearing to determine whether or not there would be a new trial, which at that point in time, I felt extremely strongly we'd have a new trial.
Yeah, if you got to that point.
Yes.
So the Mooney decision was in addition to the 50-page appeal or whatever?
I think it was about an 80 or 90-page appeal, but yes, it was in addition to that.
Okay.
We had to take out extremely salient factors in our appeal itself because the appeal has to be limited to a certain amount of words. So we actually had to actually remove some significant error that was committed at trial.
Okay. So on to a new trial.
On to a new trial.
And you asked for a bench verdict rather than a jury verdict.
I took a risk. I was out exercising one morning, as I do every morning, and I knew the judge who had been assigned. He's an experienced judge. He was a prosecutor for a number of years, dealt with him as such. I dealt with him as a judge, and I knew he was a well-reasoned, well-thought-out individual. I never really thought about waiving a jury. I just happened to be out exercising, and it popped into my head. I exercised for about the next 45 minutes thinking, this is crazy what I'm thinking. I don't really want to do that. It's just nuts. But then I came home, and I talked it over with my wife, Mary Ann, who is also an accomplished criminal defense attorney. And I went back to that jury verdict in the past. I thought, these people, I don't know what it was that they heard in order to convict Russ. And then I knew about some other Lincoln County jurors who had made some very surprising verdicts. And I talked it over with another attorney who I respect, and I said, "Is this crazy?" And it turned out, no, it wasn't crazy. So I didn't know if the prosecutor would go for it, and I didn't. And the judge doesn't have to actually agree to that. So during our next hearing, once I had talked to Russ and he agreed to do it, I popped it on the court, and the prosecutor didn't object. And so we were going to do what they call a bench trial. I had heard again that several experienced attorneys were saying, "What in the hell is Schwartz doing taking this case, high profile murder case, to a bench trial?" Because as your listeners know, one person decides as opposed to 12. If you can't convince that one person, you're going to lose. In this case, there simply wasn't a debatable or a disputable fact that pointed to Russ Faria. For example, there wasn't an eyewitness that said, "That's the man who I saw do it." There wasn't a fingerprint that said, "This is the knife that he held." There wasn't anything that became debatable, notwithstanding some slippers that had some blood splotches on them. That was it. And the slippers, to me, which was the only, they were Russ's slippers and they had blood on them. Those slippers actually, I felt, fall in the favor of an acquittal for Russ Faria. What I mean by that is they were hidden back in his closet, he and Betsy's closet. But if you take a look at the slippers, there's a swipe pattern. There was some blood on the side of the shoe, some on one side of the bottom of each shoe. What's important about that is if he was wearing them, or whoever was wearing them, when this stabbing, and remember, it's 56 stab wounds, it would have been blood spatter all over the top of the shoes. If whoever was wearing them stepped in the blood, as this, because there is some, a little bit on the side of the bottom, but not uniformly throughout the bottom, and the bottom is ridged, so there is no blood in those ridges. There's no blood throughout the exterior, throughout the bottom of the shoes. There is no bloody footprint in that blood. There's no footprint whatsoever. Not only do we not have that, the pool of blood was on a white-ish carpet, so there would have been a bloody footprint around the carpet. What that simply indicates is somebody picked them up, swiped them, and then carried them back to the closet. None of that makes any sense if it was, in fact, Russ Faria.
And the other sort of question I had was the letter that Betsy supposedly wrote.
Well, to me, okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay.
Well, the letter to me is the linchpin that proves Pam Huck did this, and proves that she plotted it out for a while. So when the police first interviewed Pam Huck, she would say, "If you could just find the letter that she was going to write me about Russ, I mean the document." And that's how she said it every time. What she was doing was directing them to Betsy's laptop and to the document section in her laptop. After the 3.5-hour interview, they asked Pam, she had already mentioned the letter three times. She talked about everything Russ was doing. She talked about the insurance proceeds. She talked about, frankly, lies about putting a pillow over Betsy's face. She talked about the knife. She talked about Betsy not wanting to go home. All of those things were incredibly important because they were all contained within the letter that Pam said she'd never seen. However, she knew every single fact in the letter.
Yes.
Once the interview was over, they said, "Is there anything we haven't asked you?" And Pam again volunteered, "If you could just find the letter that she was going to send me, I mean the document." Well, they didn't until approximately 4 years later. They went back, they looked at Betsy's laptop, and there you go. In the document section of her laptop was a letter allegedly written from Betsy to Pam. Now, the prosecutor was extremely smug, and she thought, okay, that's the dying declaration. Because what it did say is, if something happens to me, please give this letter to the police. However, as it turns out, if you looked into the forensics on Betsy's computer, that letter could not have been created on that computer because the program didn't exist to create it. If you looked at it further, it was written at a place called The Club, which is where Betsy was playing tennis for 2 hours that Thursday before when the letter had been composed. Betsy was playing tennis. I guess your listeners will never guess who was with Betsy watching her play tennis and had access to the laptop. Right, Pam. Finally, of every single document, numerous documents, contained within Betsy's document section. This one document, it said author unknown. And the only way that occurs is if somebody went in and manually changed the setting in their computer, which Betsy wouldn't know how to do. And I don't know how to do it. I don't think anybody, frankly, does unless you're a computer expert. Or two, it was written on another computer and uploaded onto Betsy's laptop that day at the club. And that's what the evidence seemed to indicate. So it really had no bearing on this particular judge, frankly, in rendering his verdict. I think this was part of his response when he said, this investigation raises more questions than it does answers. But I am certain that the new prosecutor who's handling this, a gentleman by the name of Mike Wood, will find a way to use that letter and get a conviction on Pam Hope.
That's an interesting story.
Oh, it's an incredibly interesting story. And I think it frankly just cried out to be told. It's sad. It's sad all the way around. There are people who died who didn't need to die had the police and the prosecutor done their job. And it's frightening as well. It's frightening in such a cautionary tale that Russ was a guy, relatively simple. He worked 40, 50 hours a week. Went out on the weekends with his wife, went to see his friends on Tuesday nights. This was the regular game night. Came home one night, was arrested, and didn't see the light of day for about 3.5 years till we got this overturned and he got out on bond.
Yep.
That's frightening. And as I've said, we can all look ourselves in the mirror and say, I would never commit a crime. I would never hurt somebody. But what we can't do, and unfortunately I've learned this lesson over the years, is we can't say that we'll never be charged with the crime. Hopefully, some police officers, some prosecutor or law student or somebody will take a look at this book and they'll say, you know what? This can't be me. I need to do the right thing. I need to look for justice. It's not about winning the case. And that's unfortunately what this became. It was about, frankly, beating me and winning, not about justice.
Yeah. You think there's some karma involved there in terms of the prosecuting attorney not being reelected and the judge having some reprimands against her?
I think that goes without saying. This judge, as an indirect part of this case, was suspended for 6 months without pay. They both were overwhelmingly defeated in their elections. And that's not easy to do in a small county with an incumbent.
Right.
There was a civil lawsuit where there were several $1 million awarded to us, to Russ Faria. And there has been 5 datelines. A 6th is coming out next month or sometime in early April. And that in and of itself may not sound like a lot, but I'm guessing a lot of your listeners are Dateline fans. The most that they've ever done on their highest profile, most interesting cases was 4 episodes on the O.J. Simpson case, 4 episodes on the John Benet Ramsey unsolved murder. The Russ Faria, Pam Hupp case will now have 6 episodes. They are their highest rated episodes. And there will most likely be a 7th after Pam Hupp goes to trial. If that gives you any insight into the twists and turns revolving around this case, it was a roller coaster ride. Rulings, it was a roller coaster ride of emotions all the way to the very end.
Yeah, I saw the 5th Dateline. I don't know. It had pretty much everything in it. And I said to my wife, Jill, you got to do this for the show. This is just so surreal of a case.
I'm so glad that you guys contacted me. We had an opportunity to have this conversation.
Me too. So I will mention, you've mentioned, but I want to mention your book.
Oh, well, thank you. And I hope you've had an opportunity to read it and enjoyed it.
It's a wonderfully written book.
Well, thank you so much.
Because we do a lot of reading, obviously, for doing episodes. And I just can't stand reading books that I don't really get into. I like to have a good read. And this is a great read.
Well, thank you very much. And I like some of the responses I'm getting because some of the people seem to be reliving or living for the first time what I lived in going through this. And, you know, BookBub, Goodreads, a lot of the reviews, which have been wonderful, are also, I wanted to scream. I wanted to throw the book. My blood was boiling because it makes you so angry. That's just a sliver of the emotions that I was going through. I wanted to bang my head against the bar, judge's bar. I wanted to punch somebody in the face. Obviously, we don't do those things, but that's what I was feeling.
Oh, it's a good reason.
It was crazy.
Yeah. And did you want to say anything about Pam's mother and her death at the nursing home?
Yeah, I'm not going to shy away from that. It's been reported and it's clear, and I can tell you the facts and people can make their own decisions. But Pam said on tape, videotaped to one of the officers and being questioned about Betsy's murder. She said, I know it sounds morbid, but suffice it to say, if I wanted to kill somebody, my mother's worth $500,000, which I get when she dies. She only got $150,000 for Betsy. Now, what we know about her mother is, first of all, I knew nothing about Pam's mother. And I believe earlier I described what the offer of proof was, where I was able to do some cross-examination outside the hearing of the jury. That was to preserve for the Court of Appeals. Well, during one of those sessions with Pam, she had set up a trust with 2/3 of the money she got from Betsy in it 1 week before trial.
At the suggestion of the police officer.
At the strong suggestion of the police officer.
It would look really good for you if you had that money ready to go.
That was, it would look good for us too. That was where her, his exact words. So 1 week before trial, some 2 years after Betsy's death, she set up the trust. During that cross examination, under oath, she volunteered to me, would you like to know what took me so long? And I said, yes, certainly. My mother has been sick with Alzheimer's and I've been taking care of her and she just passed away 3 weeks ago and now I had time to set it up. And I said, I'm sorry to have heard that. Well, the day after the trial, I don't know how many calls I got from so many people saying she lied under oath on the stand. Her mother did not die of Alzheimer's. Her mother fell off the third floor balcony. I did some digging. I talked to the homicide in St. Louis County. And as it turns out, her mother didn't fall off the balcony and over a railing. Her mother had 14 times the recommended dose of Ambien in her system. Her mother used a walker and was not very mobile and weighed over 200 pounds. She was found with two of the vertical railings from the rail underneath her on the concrete slab beneath her apartment. The others had been pushed out. There's been two engineer experiments that show we've taken over 2,000 pounds of pressure to have removed those balustrades or to bend them out. And most importantly, the last person with her was Pam, who then went downstairs after she left her mother and said, Mom won't be down for dinner and probably not for breakfast either. Talk about an understatement. And Pam did benefit, and I don't know how much, but I know she was one of the beneficiaries that received money from her mother's death. So suspicious, yes. To jump to the conclusion and say Pam did it, I leave that to your listeners. I know what my conclusion is. But that's now three people who Pam was with, the last person to see her alive. She benefited from all three, at least allegedly, and the last one was Gumpenberg being in an attempt to benefit from her. I've never been around somebody who I was the last person around, and I think most people haven't. The fact that over the course of a couple of years, she was around three makes it highly suspicious. She's an evil woman. No question about that.
I mean, just the description of how she recruited Gumpenberger.
It's cold, it's calculated, and it's just pure evil. Remember, this is a gentleman who was in a car accident and was operating on the level of approximately a 12-year-old, is what I've been told. She shot him, emptied her gun into him at point-blank range. Not only that, but think of what it would have to take to have the gumption to push in and pull out a knife in a friend of yours 50-something times.
Mm-hmm.
And as I've said, the suspicious nature of her mother's death is something to consider. But let's assume for a moment that she did it. You're rolling your own mother to the edge of a balcony and shoving her off. I can't imagine the evil that lurks inside that enables somebody to do something like that. It's frightening. I've said it many, many times, and I mean it. I'm an anti-gun person. I always have. If I knew then what I know now, I would have went and got a gun and I would have had it on me at all times, even at home when I answered the door, because this woman is capable of, as we now know, of anything.
Pretty much, yeah.
Yeah, clearly.
So you think she'll be charged in her mother's death? Is that?
I have spoken with the detectives and I know they're taking a new look at it. The manner of death was altered by the coroner from accidental to undetermined, yeah, which leaves it open. And I'm guessing they will not. I would say if I was defending her on something like that, although it's a pretty darn good circumstantial case, there may be a hole or two that you could poke in it. I still think you'd get a conviction out of it. Nevertheless, if something happens in Lincoln County and she gets the death penalty or is convicted of murder first, I don't know why the resources at that point in time would be expended to pursue her, the death of her mother.
Right. And when's the trial start for her?
There is not a trial date yet. Because they're asking for the death penalty and because she's doing life without parole already, I don't think anybody's in any hurry. And I would be shocked if it was before 2023 or 2024.
Okay. But there will likely be a trial.
Well, Mike Wood, the prosecutor, doesn't seem to be interested in any deals other than the death penalty.
Okay.
So if that's the case, there would likely be a trial.
Well, justice.
And she would be the first woman ever convicted and given the death penalty by the state of Missouri. That's a record right there.
No kidding.
No.
All right. Well, I think you've answered all my questions that I had written down.
Good. I'm always available by you or if anybody wants to. My website is joeljschwartz.com. That's joeljschwartz.com. And if anybody has any individual questions, I will respond. I promise you. You can email me, you can use social media, whatever you need to do. And if after you read the book, you have any comments on it, good or bad, I'm anxious and interested to hear them. I think everything is fair game. Okay. So I appreciate your time and I appreciate your listeners' time.
I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us. And again, people are listening to this, buy the book, Bone Deep.
I really appreciate that. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for agreeing to do this. Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
I know.